I'm happy now to welcome William Brown. He's a retired earth scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey, and currently he's a consultant on global warming, climate change and energy science, and technology policy and economics, and he will be speaking about climate change and the water and energy future of New Mexico. This is a lecture in the Amigos Bravos Water Matters lecture series, and it'll happen on Tuesday, July 16th at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Community Foundation. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you have talked and written about the energy-water nexus. How are energy and water connected and interdependent? There's so many ways.
Yes, the energy-water nexus is a technical term that talks about the interdependence of energy and water, and it's used worldwide as we're looking at more and more uses of water for energy generation. So it has to do with the water that's required for power plant cooling, for example, the water that's required to drill for oil and gas, the water that's required to mine and process coal, and then it also has to do with the energy that's required to move water from one place to another, such as with pumping, that sort of thing.
So water is used in energy production, and energy is also used to get water, move it around, disinfect it, treat it, and then heat it. And that's a lot of energy. It's actually a significant part of our annual energy use.
In fact, it is. As a lot of this is fairly new in terms of analyzing the data, but the most recent work that's been done on this show that about 12-13% of our energy that's produced nationwide in the United States goes to the water energy nexus. And for southwestern states, we have data from California in particular, and California uses about 19% of its electricity generation for water purposes of several types, like you just mentioned.
And that's been a huge change in the last century. Whether it be California or New Mexico, we use an ever-increasing amount of energy on water.
That's correct. And the projections for the future are that we're going to continue to use a lot more. In fact, the International Energy Agency just put out a report this month that's indicating by 2035, we will double the amount of water that we're devoting to the water energy nexus globally. And that's really significant.
Very much so. And I mean, people talk about desalinization and having pipelines for water the way we now have pipelines for fuel. And all of that takes a huge amount of energy. Let's talk about New Mexico for a moment. Where do we get our water here in New Mexico? And how has that changed over the last century?
Well, our water in New Mexico primarily comes from the Rio Grande and from the Colorado River systems, either directly or by diversions, such as the San Juan Chama project that diverts water from the Colorado over to the Rio Grande and down through Espanola. And we get water from our groundwater aquifers that are scattered around the state. So those are the primary water sources for the state of New Mexico.
And how has demand for water in New Mexico changed?
Like everywhere else, particularly in the American Southwest, the demand keeps growing with population and commercial industrial growth. That's been a major factor throughout the American West for the past several decades, and there are no signs that it's slowing down by any means. A lot of new growth, both for infrastructure development and through population, is occurring in our region. And that just puts more and more demands on these water systems that we're relying on.
Now, some of the dangers, of course, are that the rivers are running dry and that we are taking water out of the ground faster than it's recharging.
Exactly. Both of those things are happening. With climate change, we're losing a significant portion of our annual precipitation as the storm tracks shift north and migrate north, particularly in the springtime. So we're looking out towards the middle of the 21st century, and perhaps even sooner, at losing 25% or more of our long-term average water resource, the waters that feed the Rio Grande and the Colorado in particular, particularly the snow and snowmelt runoff. So we're getting a decrease in water availability that way, and of course an increase in demand because of people moving in and the demands they bring with them.
Now, people are moving in and they bring demands with them, but as we know, 75% of the water is actually used for agriculture. So when we talk about saving water, that seems to be the place to look. Is that not true?
That's correct. Actually, overall, agricultural irrigation uses about 39-40% of the water that's withdrawn from our rivers. Thermoelectric power withdraws almost an equal percentage, about 41%. So those numbers are significant. Agriculture apparently consumes a lot more water because the water that goes to agricultural fields is caught up in the evapotranspiration of plants and in evaporating into the atmosphere, where in the case of thermoelectric power, some of the water can actually be returned to the river system that it comes from. So there are differences along those lines. But indeed, agriculture and thermoelectric power are the two big water withdrawing entities that we have to deal with and to try to make them much more efficient. In the case of the American Southwest in particular, it's probably going to cause us to move to very different kinds of crops in the future. We're not going to be able to continue the same kinds of water-consumptive crops in the Southwest on less water than we've been used to in the past. And so there's going to be some dramatic times ahead for farming and agriculture in the Southwest.
We're talking to William Brown about water use, and I think it's very important to talk about how water is used in power production, in power plants. Can you explain that to us if you have a coal-fired or another kind of electricity-generating plant? What is the water actually used for?
In thermoelectric power plants, which can be nuclear, coal, natural gas, biofuels, or even solar thermal plants, the water is generally used for cooling. There are some other purposes for water. For example, in a solar plant, you would use it to wash the mirrors and that kind of thing. But these plants produce energy by producing an enormous amount of heat. The heat comes from burning the particular fuel, whether it's uranium or coal, and that excess heat has to be dissipated in some way so that the plant can operate properly. So water is taken from a river, for example. It's run through the plant to cool the heated systems, and then it either evaporates to the atmosphere, it's recirculated, or it's discharged into evaporation ponds, or it's discharged back into a water source like a river or an ocean.
Now, it's also used, I mean, these plants boil water, and it's the steam that generates the electricity. Is that not the case?
Yeah, that's the case. And that steam goes into a turbine that generates the power. Nearly all of these thermoelectric plants operate the same way. Again, it doesn't matter which type. You generate heat to heat water. The water goes through a heat exchanger and exchanges that heat to make steam, and then the steam runs a turbine that produces electricity. So that's the kind of the basic explanation of how these systems work.
Why do they not all have just simply closed-loop recirculating systems? You boil water, it turns into steam, then it condenses, cools, and then goes back and gets reboiled and so on. One would think that if the water were continually recirculating, you have a big use of water once, but then it doesn't need to be replenished all that much.
Well, that's entirely correct, and it varies from place to place. In cooler, wetter areas of the country, that approach is not so necessary. It's almost absolutely necessary in the American Southwest, however. And most of our power plants do use recirculating systems by law. They're pretty much mandated to do it just because we don't have a lot of water available for any other type of system. We can't afford to not recirculate water as many times as we can through the plants. On the other hand, it's an economic decision as well. The more recirculation that is used, the costlier it is to operate the plant, and the costlier becomes the electricity that's generated. There are a variety of types of plants around the country based on these characteristics and how the water is used and how it's recirculated, whether it goes once through the plant or whether it goes through the plant several times, depends a lot on local policies or statewide policies.
If recirculation is the law in New Mexico, then why does electric generation use so much water?
No matter how you cut it, it takes a lot of water to generate electricity. And so they're constantly, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, year around, decade around, are pumping water and recirculating it and evaporating it to the atmosphere. So even though we're using water in a more efficiently in a recirculating process, we're still losing water through evaporation.
Let's talk about the energy sector in terms of things like hydraulic fracturing, oil and gas production. Those not only use a lot of water, they pollute a lot of water, and that water is generally not able to be reclaimed or cleaned. Why is that? What does that look like?
That's exactly right. The amount that's used for the drilling and production operations of an oil or a gas well vary considerably from place to place, depending on the geology, depending on how deep the drilling has to go for natural gas, for example. As one example, in the state of Texas, the average water use at a well for hydraulic fracturing is about 6 million gallons of water. In California, where there are resources closer to the surface, the average is about 500,000 or about a half million gallons of water. And so you can figure that most places are in the range of, say, a million to several million gallons of water just for the hydraulic fracturing activities for a single well. And adding up all of these gallons of water and multiplying it by the number of wells that are drilled, you get a tremendous amount of water. The water generally comes from relatively local sources, such as the local groundwater aquifer or perhaps a local reservoir where the energy companies can buy water and use it for their operations. And after the use of the water, then the water is disposed of by reinjecting it into the ground at great depth, maybe several thousand feet. That's typical of what's done in New Mexico by state law requiring the reinjection of the water into the deep groundwater.
But isn't it dirty by the time they reinject it?
Oh, yes. Yeah. The water going through power plants, the water used for oil and gas well drilling, all of this either starts out with some contamination because of its location near coal and natural gas beds, or it's contaminated otherwise through the processes of extracting the oil and natural gas. So, yeah, the water gets contaminated that way. And the expectation is, I assume, that this water, by being injected a couple of miles deep into the ground, that becomes not a problem in terms of contamination. However, it takes away the water from the existing groundwater resource.
Let's talk about looking at clean energy production. When you look at all the different sectors of electricity generation, energy production, how do they compare in terms of water use? Are renewable sources less water intensive or the same? What does it look like?
Well, the clean energy sources such as solar thermal, solar photovoltaic, and wind turbine use insignificant, almost trivial amounts of water by comparison with any other type of generation.
Even solar thermal?
Yes. Solar thermal power can use a lot of water or a little water. And practically speaking, and certainly for the American Southwest, the solar thermal plants that are being built across the Southwest from the Mojave Desert into Colorado and even New Mexico use dry cooling, which cuts their water use by about 95%.
Wow.
And so solar thermal technology is one of the leaders in dry cooling technology and the ability to apply it. There's no reason for solar thermal to use a lot of water. As a comparison, a generic coal plant uses almost 700 gallons of water for every megawatt hour of electricity produced. A solar thermal plant with dry cooling will use about one-tenth of that amount, and a solar photovoltaic plant will use about one-twentieth of that amount.
And so when you look forward, what do you see in New Mexico as the potential for those sources of clean energy? I mean, right now, and if we find methods of energy storage in the future, this could change, but right now they're kind of capricious in the sense that you only can get wind when it's windy, you can only get sun when it's sunny, and so on.
Well, all of that is sort of a myth, really, because we can produce solar thermal power around the clock. And by interconnecting a large number of wind-generating systems, we can produce wind power continuously. So it's basically a matter of scale, and it's a matter of applying the technology that we already use. Right now, there are three solar thermal plants being built in the United States by a company called Solar Reserve that is an international company headquartered in Santa Monica, California. One of those plants is going to be built rather close to where I live here in the just north of New Mexico in the San Luis Valley of southern Colorado. This plant will produce 100 megawatts of power, and it will store heat, that is excess heat that's generated during the day, and that'll allow the plant to run continuously 24 hours a day without any fossil fuel backup. So these are these plants are actually have been constructed and proven and demonstrated elsewhere in the world, and they're being built here in the United States right now. One of the largest solar power plants in the world is being built in the Ivanpah Valley of California, and it's the same kind of thing. It'll run, operate on around the clock on the heat energy that's stored during the daytime for running at night or when it's cloudy, that kind of thing.
So this has a greater potential than probably any of us thought. I mean, there have been, up to this point, because of these limitations, kind of the common knowledge is that you can get up to 20-25% clean energy, but no more. So you're saying you could get a higher percentage of our total energy production from clean sources.
Like, oh, absolutely. This is not new technology. It's not unusual. It's been going on for years. California built the Cramer Junction solar thermal electric power plant in 1984. It generates today 354 megawatts of power. That's a pretty sizable plant. And that plant operates pretty much around the clock, although the technology that it was built with allow it to have a certain amount of natural gas backup for peaking power and for periods of cloudiness, but very little of that is ever used. So the technology's been with us for about 30 years. The idea that this technology doesn't exist is somewhat of a myth, and it's a myth that's been perpetuated throughout society by, you know, the fossil fuel misinformation campaign. And this has been going on for quite a long time. So, I always try to encourage people that you have to realize exactly what is happening in the solar and wind power industries and how efficient and cost competitive they really are. And it is only a matter of just simply deciding that that's the kind of energy that we want to go to rather than using more expensive and less efficient energy systems like fossil fuels and nuclear power.
Well, the sort of common wisdom about that, which you're telling us maybe isn't true, is that coal may be dirty, it may be ruining the entirety of Appalachia, it may be all kinds of things, but it's cheap. Is that not true?
The cost of these things depends on how you look at it. Most of the so-called cheapness of coal and even nuclear power is kind of an illusion because of the subsidies that we pay these industries for the production of these fuels. And if you don't count the subsidies, then the cost is apparently less. So that's what we're seeing. It's the hidden subsidy cost of coal and nuclear power and even natural gas and oil that raises the price, the true cost of these different kinds of energies, particularly compared you know, if you want to compare the cost of solar and wind technology.
And also, if you factor in the price to the environment and the price to human health, then it's astronomical.
Yeah, those are called external costs, and again, they're not factored into the comparisons. I'm looking at comparisons with a nuclear power plant type that is being pushed right now. It's called modular nuclear reactors. They're small-scale reactors that the industry is claiming can be placed in a number of places for little cost, if you will. And I'm also looking at the solar reserve power plant to be built in the San Luis Valley of Southern Colorado. And I'm looking at these for a specific purpose. The Taos County in New Mexico, where I live, could operate all of its electrical and transportation demands and growth demands for the next 50 years or so on about 100 megawatts. That's what we would need as a power station in Taos County, locally owned and operated, to supply all of our demands through most of the rest of this century. So 100 megawatts is the figure I'm looking at. Now, to build that plant with a solar thermal system would cost about a little more than $500 million, about $0.6 billion. To build an equivalent nuclear power plant to produce approximately 100 megawatts would cost about $5 billion. So there's a factor of 10 in the cost. It costs 10 times more to build a nuclear power plant to produce the same amount of power as it does to build a solar power plant.
So what's in the way of these solar plants being built?
Usually it's a matter of local support, local policy, state and federal regulations that provide subsidies to different forms of power. What we need to do is equalize the subsidy payments across all forms of energy generation, or alternatively, we just need to remove the subsidy payments for all forms of power, and then we would see a rapid ascendancy of solar and wind power. They're already competitive and, in many cases, much economically cheaper than fossil fuel and nuclear energy today. It's just a matter of deciding that that's the way we want to go.
We're talking to William Brown about the water energy nexus. So basically, the way forward for New Mexico, in your view, is as much solar and wind as you possibly could have. Do you need, for plants like that, do you need some kind of fossil fuel backup?
It's possible. That could be done. There are some cases where that's being attempted around the country right now. Florida Power and Light was one of the first to do this. They're building a concentrated solar thermal electric plant right adjacent to a natural gas power plant at one of their sites in Florida. And what this does, it allows the solar plant to take over particularly the peak demands of power during the hotter parts of the day when people are turning on their air conditioning systems all around southern Florida, and reducing considerably the need for natural gas. And by continuing to build out the solar power facility, the natural gas plant becomes more and more of a backup. That could easily be done anywhere with any of our plants in the Southwest. We could start doing that right now today, what we call just co-locating, actually build a solar plant at the same location where the fossil fuel or nuclear power plants already exist, and continue to build up the capacity of solar power while reducing the demand for nuclear and fossil fuel power.
And so actually using the same turbines, the same infrastructure?
Exactly. That's one of the beautiful things about it. The infrastructure is already in place.
Very interesting. What kind of movement exists right now to make that happen? I mean, this co-location is, maybe lots of people know about this, but this is the first I've heard of it.
Well, it's certainly happening throughout the industry. If you track the industry like I do, I follow the industry worldwide and what's going on and in other countries nationally and such. And it's kind of an inevitable process, really. People that are smart about their money, the big venture capitalists, banks and such like that, are moving a lot of money into clean energy systems and moving it away from a dirty energy system. And I think that's going to continue in a big way. The other thing that's happening is that the overall costs of solar and wind, whether it's solar thermal or solar photovoltaic and wind turbines, is declining precipitously. The cost is just dropping dramatically year by year, whereas all of the cost of nuclear and coal and other fossil fuel generation is going up. And we've reached the point here in this decade where those lines have crossed each other, with the solar and wind costs dropping below the uprising costs of fossil fuels and nuclear power. That basic economic equation is going to drive a lot of new investment and new policy that attends to, you know, building a new global clean energy system.
Where
the other thing that has to happen that would make it happen even faster is to put a price on the emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. Once that those pollutants are properly priced, then that provides an enormous amount of money to be reinvested into clean energy systems that do not produce greenhouse gas emissions. So those are the two big overarching things that are going on, and they're economic drivers of a new energy economy.
Where does rooftop solar fit into all of this?
Rooftop solar fits into all of this very much like the personal computer fits into computing. If you think back, it wasn't that long ago when there was a conflict between central station computing, you know, large mainframe computers that people could tap into and would do the computing for them, and simultaneously the development of the personal computer, where people could have their own computing capacity happening right in their own business or in their own home. That same analogy could be applied to central station power and widely distributed power, the widely distributed power being rooftop solar, community solar, small microgrids built for communities and counties, that kind of thing. I think that's also inevitable. Like, the costs are becoming so attractive and so appealing for that right now that it's almost ridiculous not to invest in it. The economics are such that investing in rooftop solar is a better investment. It's one of the best investments that you can make for return on your money today, if you're looking at anything in even the short to medium term for a return on your investment. The systems pay for themselves in a very few years, and your electricity becomes free after that point.
And you have the satisfaction of lowering your carbon footprint.
Yeah, there's that advantage too. But aside from that, it's just just pure fundamental economics. And we have to make the general public aware that this is possible, and have to make sure that people are aware that they can invest in solar power that they can generate on their own properties and make a decent financial return on it in a very short period of time, just like they would invest in anything else, like the stock market or whatever.
William Brown is a retired earth scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey and is a consultant on climate change, energy science, technology, policy, and economics. He will be speaking about climate change and the water and energy future of New Mexico on Tuesday, July 16th at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Community Foundation. It's part of the Amigos Bravos Water Matters Lecture Series. You can find out more at amigosbravos.org. William, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Okay, appreciate it very much, and I hope to see all of you at the lecture in Santa Fe on Tuesday evening at 5:30.
Excellent. Thanks for being with us. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Lucy Moore. She is an environmental and public policy mediator and consultant, and she's author of a couple of books. The new one is called Common Ground on Hostile Turf, Stories from an Environmental Mediator, and she will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore this Thursday, the 18th of July, at 6 o'clock in the evening, and she'll be there along with the wonderful James McGrath Morris. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte, very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, being an environmental mediator, first of all, what is a mediator? What do mediators do?
Yeah, a mediator is not a meditator. I sometimes get, you know, people that have looked in the phone book or whatever, they'll call up and they'll say, well, now do I bring my own cushions?
Oh,
or,
yeah, Lord.
I know. So it's a very important and very basic question.
Yeah, the letter T.
That's right. Save one letter. So the key thing about a mediator, a couple of key things. One is the mediator has absolutely no stake in the outcome of the dispute. And the second thing is the mediator, it helps the parties come to their own solution. A mediator never, tempting as it might be at times, never comes up with the solution. So an arbitrator eventually will say, I've heard everything I need to hear, and this is how this is going to be. And a mediator never does that. If the parties, whether it's a divorcing couple, whether it's, as I work with 10 different interest groups around a table, arguing about an environmental issue, if they can't come to their own solution, which hopefully I guide them through a process so they can do that, if they can't come up with anything, they don't. That's that.
Now, one of the ways that you define mediator is a person who lets everybody hear each other's story, something like that?
Right, right. I really think there are all kinds of fancy definitions for mediation and what the mediator does, but I really think that's the heart of the matter, is that we each have got a story to tell, many, many stories, but at any given time, kind of the key story about where we're at, and that people that are in conflict together have definitely got a core story to tell, and that if we can express those stories and hear each other's stories, we can build a foundation, a human connection with each other, that will get us toward then working on some kind of solution. People often think that the answer to resolving a dispute is, well, if we only could get enough data on this particular subject, or when my model of groundwater quality is completed, then we will have, the answer will be very clear. Or when this lawsuit gets settled, then it will be very clear. And I really don't think it's about that. I think it's about people connecting and figuring out their own solutions based on their personal connections. If they can't make that connection, all the data, all the lawsuits, all the information in the world isn't going to mean anything to them. They will block it out. They won't hear it. They won't want to understand it. They won't want to look at it because they're not in a position where they can relax enough to trust and open up with each other.
Right. I mean, it underlines once again that all of life is actually about human relationships and human and environmental, all life relationships, and those interactions are what it's all about. And there's a lot of mistrust. In a place like New Mexico, there are, and you talked about this early in your book, you have a meeting with people about water issues, and they just look at you and say, you're a white outsider, and you're probably working for a foundation, aren't you? And there has been a tremendous amount of mistrust of foundations.
Exactly, exactly. That was a very painful early learning experience for me doing this kind of work in New Mexico, and a really important lesson that I'm very grateful for. I was not so grateful at the time because I was in a lot of pain over it. But yes, the idea that outsiders like me, I've been in New Mexico since 1975, but still consider myself certainly not a native and an outsider in a lot of respects, and just the idea that we can come in with connections to foundations, with political connections perhaps, or whatever, educational advantages, and decide in a sense what is needed for northern New Mexico, for instance, how to help with all the good intentions in the world. We arrive wanting to help desperately, but without really the understanding that we need to listen and learn from these people that were so eager to help. And so that was a very early lesson and a very important one.
We're talking to Lucy Moore about her book Common Ground on Hostile Turf. There is a very poignant chapter in which you describe a group of people who are grazing sheep in a way that they've been grazing sheep, gathering wool, and weaving for really hundreds of years. And the land that they had been grazing on for untold generations suddenly becomes wildlife conservation and they're not allowed to graze their sheep, and there's literally no place for them to go. And this becomes a conflict between environmentalists and local people who've been here for a very long time and who aren't going anywhere. And you paint this picture of environmentalists as sort of naive, well-meaning nomads who swoop into one place, try to help, and then kind of, well, if it doesn't work here, we'll go save some other part of the planet kind of thing. Whereas the people, the New Mexicans, are like, we've been here forever. This is our land. Do you think we have not been good land stewards? And it's a fascinating portrayal of the deepest kinds of cultural differences.
Exactly. And again, that was a key case for me early on in my career to work with. It was the Ganados del Valle Wool Growers Co-op up north and a group of environmentalists in Santa Fe, and who, just as I explained about myself coming in with foundation connections and wanting to help, the environmentalists, I put myself in that same kind of camp of being idealistic and thinking that we know what is needed, and they had come in the same way with some very rigid ideas about what is good for the land and whether or not sheep grazing is compatible with wildlife management. And that was really the heart of that particular dispute. Could you graze sheep in a wildlife management area? And the environmentalists had to realize, first of all, how they were perceived by the local people. And it was very confusing for them and hurtful for them to realize that they weren't the good guys. I remember meeting with the wonderful David Henderson, who has left us, very unfortunately. And he was beside himself because he said, we're the ones that usually are holding baby harp seals, and we're the ones that everybody is sympathetic to and wanting. We're on the winning side, and we're not in this case. We're the evil guys. We're the guys that are trying to shut down this traditional culture, and I don't understand it, and I don't want to be in that position. That, you know, for him to be open like that and for his colleagues to be open and willing to learn how it was they were seen and to really give some deep thought to how to care for the land in a compromising way, in a sense, is very difficult. Environmentalists, like many of us, are incredibly passionate.
There can be a fundamentalist streak. But I mean, I think one of the ways that environmentalism is going is realizing that people live on the land. And this is an example of that. We've also done programs about wildlife conservation in Africa, where if you try to build wildlife areas and don't take into account people, it is just certain failure.
Right.
But, I mean, the thing that was painful for me reading this chapter is that they didn't... It was so condescending toward people who had been grazing sheep for hundreds of years. It wasn't like this was a mega cattle installation where they come and graze the land to bare earth and leave it destroyed. It's people who actually know way more about that piece of land than those who were trying to save the wildlife on it and who'd been doing it in an environmental way. And it's like, why is that compromise?
Right, exactly. And the evident, the very fact that the environmentalists who moved here, and I think all of them had moved here from somewhere else, moved here because it was so gorgeous. You know, one of them said, well, I've just lived all over the country, but this is the most beautiful, the mountains of northern New Mexico. That's where I knew when I saw them I had to be there. Well, how did they get so beautiful, and how did those valleys that are grazed all the time remain that way, as you exactly say, through the stewardship of the people that have been there forever?
Now, that chapter has a kind of surprise ending in it, which I think I'm not going to let people know, because it's extremely interesting, and it's a book so worth reading, Common Ground on Hostile Turf, Stories from an Environmental Mediator. One thing that one does while reading a book like this is I imagine myself in your position, Lucy Moore, being among all of these people who are feeling hostile toward one another, sometimes hostile toward you. You might be perceived as being on one side or the other, even though you're the supposedly neutral mediator. And just on an emotional level, I mean, these debates about policy and about the environment, about ways of life, are ultimately deeply emotional situations. How do you handle it? How do you keep yourself in a place of balance?
That's a really good question, and I think I'm just constitutionally put together to be able to do that. I care deeply about people. I believe that those human connections are all we have to offer each other when it comes right down to it, and that the common ground we can find among ourselves and those connections is the only thing that's going to save us. And so I just put my energy into that. If I do think that I come home sometimes, especially if I've been with a group that's in a lot of pain, a lot of historical pain, or I did some work out at the Homestake Uranium site. I ran a community meeting out there for EPA that I talk about in the book. And those people have been so abused and are suffering enormous health and economic and social and cultural abuses that are just really unfathomable. And as an empathetic person, as you and I are, you take that with you. And the problem is that in the work I'm doing, there isn't anything I can do about that. I can, some things I can help find solutions to, but a situation like that, I can't do anything about. And those are the tough ones.
There's also the fact that you are continually faced with unwieldy bureaucracies that aren't always talking to each other, aren't always coordinating with each other, probably more often than not aren't, and so many people whose lives are affected, sometimes horribly affected, by these gigantic bureaucracies. And if you're a land-based person, bureaucracy shouldn't even really have to exist, and instead it rules your life.
Right. The think of a land-based community in northern New Mexico. I mean, everything is connected. And a lot of times I work with tribes, and they're mystified by the divisions of U.S. bureaucracy. Why is there a Forest Service, and then why is there a Department of Interior that deals with water, and then why on earth would you have wildlife in the Fish and Wildlife Service? And why would there be a Department of Education when all of those things, our youth, our elder care, the health of our land, the health of our wildlife, our cultural survival is all one thing? And so it's very difficult for people in that position, and you can understand it. It makes a lot of sense. Very hard for them to deal with what comes at them in terms of decision-making about important aspects of their lives. The Department of Health comes in with something that makes no sense to them in terms of the education of their young people or in terms of collecting traditional plants for medicinal purposes, and they can't get at the problem because everything is siloed, as they say these days. And
yeah.
And from the bureaucratic point of view, I'm sympathetic to them too. I mean, if you're with the Forest Service and somebody comes to you with a problem relating to the Forest Service and you're dealing with it and with forest issues, and all of a sudden you're talking about sacred sites and about the importance of keeping traditions alive, that Forest Service bureaucrat has a very tough time dealing with that. They want to take care of it. They've got a job to do, and they want to be responsible. They want to take care of it, and yet that's outside their bounds. So all they can say is, well, I don't really have anything to do with that. And that just piles onto the frustration of, oh, my God, the U.S. government comes, and then they tell us all this confusing stuff, and then they can't help us anyway. And they don't, you know. So it's a deep mismatch of world views.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, these cultural differences are so profound. It's not like, you know, we eat spaghetti and you eat something else.
Right.
And when you were talking about all these different bureaucracies and all these different specialties, it really sounds for all the world like different approaches to medicine. Like, are you treating the whole person, or is like, okay, you go to the dermatologist for this and you go to the lung doctor for that, but in fact those things are related, and if they were seen as being related, we could get healthier a lot faster.
Exactly. That's a great analogy. Yeah.
So 25 years of mediation, what's the perhaps biggest thing that you have learned about doing your work in all this time?
I think probably the biggest thing is that it is much simpler than I ever dreamed. And I think that a lot of mediators out there would benefit from simplifying, reducing what it is we do down to some very bare essentials about helping people understand each other. And that if we can do that, we can deal with the technical parts, the informational parts, the complex parts, much more easily than we thought we could. In the beginning when I was a mediator, I thought, oh my God, this is such an overwhelming job. I've got to master hazardous waste siting in the United States. I've got to understand this toxicity on the water and this and that in the air. And that's just, I don't need to do that. Maybe I've gotten tired after 25 years and don't want to do it, but I really don't think it's necessary, and I really think it actually kind of gets in the way. So my message to fellow practitioners, and more importantly to all of us out there who find ourselves in conflict, whether one-on-one or whether some big neighborhood thing or something bigger than that, is to listen, is to be respectful to that other side that you may be demonizing, and they may be demonizing you. You're gonna have to get past that. You're gonna have to settle down, listen, learn, and be very thoughtful about what the future holds and what the best solution is going to be.
Lucy Moore is author of the book Common Ground on Hostile Turf, Stories from an Environmental Mediator, and she will be at Collected Works Bookstore this Thursday, the 18th of July at 6 in the evening. She'll be there with James McGrath Morris. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's always a pleasure.